Okay, so we're very happy to have Mark from Ramsung join us virtually from UBC. And Mark's going to talk about, well, microscopic models of Big Bang cosmology and a lot of other things which are interesting and sort of have received a bunch of focus recently in holography and cosmology. So Mark, take it away.
Okay. Well, thanks for the invitation. It's always nice to visit Waterloo. I'm going to talk about some work. I'm going to review some work from a couple of years ago and then talk about various more recent developments along these lines, including some work in progress. And so the general idea here is that in quantum gravity, one of the big questions that we want to make progress on is understanding cosmology and the Big Bang. And in ADS-CFT, it seems to be a challenge since we have generally some fixed asymptotic boundary of space-time. We've made much more progress recently in understanding the physics of black holes, especially in the last year. So the goal of this talk is to kind of use our success in describing black hole physics to maybe make some headway in understanding cosmology. And so it starts with a basic picture that we described in this black hole microstate cosmology paper a couple of years ago. So here's the hope. The idea is that we want to consider some ordinary example of ADS-CFT. In order to describe 4D cosmology, we're going to think of a 4D CFT. So let's take the CFT on a sphere if we wanted to describe a closed universe, or on R3 if we want a flat universe. And I want to choose some particular state of this CFT. It's going to be some high energy state. So it would be dual to a black hole space-time. This is a pure state. So this is a particular microstate from the gravity description. And the idea is that on the gravity side, it looks like an ordinary Schwarzschild black hole outside the horizon. But then you have some interesting structure of the space-time behind the horizon. So if we go past the horizon, then the space-time has some kind of an inner boundary that I'm going to call an end-of-the-world brain. And I'll describe what this might be microscopically later on. But for now, we can think of it as some inner boundary of the space-time. And this end-of-the-world brain has an interesting time dependence. So from the world volume point of view, this end-of-the-world brain is a spherical space that starts out at zero size at this past singularity, increases, and then shrinks again. And so the geometry is an FRW, Big Bang, Big Crunch universe. Now, normally that wouldn't be particularly relevant for cosmology because this is simply the boundary of our space-time. It's not that we have a gravitational theory in this universe. The gravity is five-dimensional instead of four-dimensional. However, there's one situation where we might actually have effectively four-dimensional gravitational physics. And that would be if this end-of-the-world brain is actually quite far behind the black hole horizon. If you can think of it as some kind of a cutoff brain, cutting off the second asymptotic region of the extended black hole space-time, then the physics that Randall and Sundaram explained, and later Karch and Randall, is that you can actually localize gravity. So some part of the 5D graviton can be localized on the end of the world brain, on this, what people call the Planck brain. And then effectively, the gravitational theory would be four-dimensional. And so you would have effectively, at least for some amount of time, some four-dimensional gravitational theory, and the universe being described by that would look like an FRW expanding and contracting universe. And it may be that this four-dimensional description is only valid for part of the time. And so the actual Big Bang or Big Crunch, it would require thinking about higher dimensional gravity, 5D gravity, or in a microscopic context, maybe 10D gravity or string theory. Okay, so this is the basic picture that we hope to realize. And now I want to try to fill in some of the details of what is this state and why do we believe it would be described by a geometry like this? And what has to be true to actually realize all of these things? Towards the end, the last half of the talk is going to be dedicated to actually coming up with microscopic models from string theory that perhaps realize this. So the states that I want to focus on are constructed using a particular kind of Euclidean path integral. And so I'll remind you that the vacuum state of a CFT on a sphere, we could describe that by this Euclidean path integral where we introduce a semi-infinite interval of Euclidean time, and we just define the vacuum wave functional for field configurations on the sphere as the path integral over all configurations of this Euclidean field theory, where the fields on the time equals zero surface agree with the configuration that we're evaluating the wave functional on. Okay, so this is basically just the standard thing from quantum field theory where the vacuum is obtained starting from some arbitrary reference state by an infinite amount of Euclidean time evolution. In our situation, I want to consider a similar path integral, except we only have a finite amount of Euclidean time evolution. And at this past boundary in Euclidean time, we introduce some boundary condition for our conformal field theory, possibly with some extra degrees of freedom, some extra Euclidean degrees of freedom living on this boundary. Okay, so let me be very explicit about what I mean by this theory constructing the state. So we introduce this Euclidean boundary conformal field theory. This was our original conformal field theory. Now there's some Euclidean time, and now we place this boundary in Euclidean time. And we introduce possibly extra fields here, so extra degrees of freedom living there. And then the whole thing, even though we've introduced a boundary, the actual theory that we're describing is still the same. It's just our original CFT. There aren't any new degrees of freedom that we're adding here. We're just adding them into the Euclidean path integral. And so the point of these is that they generate some interesting state. And so the state can be described by its wave function. The wave function on this field configuration phi zero is equal to the integral over all configurations of the bulk fields which are equal to phi zero at the t equals zero surface. And we integrate over all configurations of these boundary degrees of freedom, and we weight the whole thing by some action for the combined bulk and boundary degrees of freedom. So the action of our boundary conformal field theory. Okay. And so by choosing different boundary theories here or different boundary conditions, we can get different states. But the state is completely specified once we say what is the boundary physics and what is the amount of Euclidean time evolution. Okay, feel free to jump in with questions, by the way.
So since you said that, do you mind if you go, shouldn't there be like your initial condition somewhere in that path integral?
So it's a Euclidean path integral. So it's kind of like the Hartle-Hawking construction where you just integrate over everything with the right boundary conditions.
But you said you want to put some stuff on phi b, so it should be like a psi of phi b.
You can think of the state as being defined at time zero. I mean, similar to this case, you know, we're just trying to define a state at time zero in the Lorentzian picture. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we just integrate over all these field configurations in the Euclidean picture. So I could have written that infinite cylinder as a disk in conformal field theory. So it's just like integrating everything over it, all configurations on the disk. In this case, in that disk picture, we're just now introducing an inner boundary. So it's an annulus, and then we're just integrating over everything inside that can live on the annulus.
Okay, thanks.
If I can also ask a real quick question.
Yeah.
So are we sort of supposed to think of this as like a overcomplete like parameterization of my state. So if like,
I think these are specifics to, I mean, I'm going to focus on translation and variant boundary conditions here. So I think the set of states that I'm talking about here are not all of the states of the CFT. They're all going to be, rotationally invariant on this sphere. So that'll be a special set of states. I could consider more general states by adding sources or different spatially dependent boundary conditions, but I will be focusing on just a symmetric set. So,
okay, yeah. Thanks.
Okay, so this is a special class of states of my CFT. And the idea, the expectation is that if tau zero becomes large, then I recover the vacuum state. If tau zero is small, then there should be some high energy state. That actually in the limit where tau zero goes to zero, at least the expectation is normally that these kinds of states are singular. So we want to understand the gravity dual for such a state and see, does it look like one of these spacetimes? And so let me kind of remind you of how we might do that. So the first thing we have to understand is, how do we deal with the addition of this boundary to our CFT, to our Euclidean CFT, when we're thinking about EDS CFT? And so here's sort of a basic schematic picture. We start with a holographic CFT, and now we've added a boundary. And this is a Euclidean picture in our case. What happens on the gravity side? Well, the bulk CFT was dual to some asymptotically ADS spacetime. But there should be something corresponding to this boundary in our CFT. And this I'm going to call an end of the world brain. So there must be some way in which the bulk spacetime is modified compared to just having the entirety of ADS. And so we should have something coming in from this CFT boundary going into the bulk and kind of ending the spacetime, some bulk analog of the boundary that we introduce into the CFT. Okay. So in this, in sort of a bottom-up description, one could model this by just adding some kind of a boundary action with various parameters and maybe extra fields living on this boundary, and these can couple to the bulk fields. So there would be a bottom-up description of this where you just choose what action you want to work with. But in microscopic models, this end of the world brain doesn't necessarily have to be a specific object separate from the rest of the degrees of freedom. So what we'll see later is that in some microscopic supersymmetric examples of this, this end of the world brain is simply a place where the internal geometry of your higher dimensional solution degenerates in some way, and it could be a smooth degeneration. So a familiar example of this would be the bubble of nothing kind of space-time, where you have one extra dimension that's circular, and the bubble of nothing has a boundary which corresponds to the circular direction just pinching off smoothly. So from the lower dimensional perspective, your space-time has this edge, the edge of the bubble. But from the higher dimensional perspective, it's really just a smooth space-time.
Okay. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I mean, in the picture where, let's say, you have a theory of quantum gravity in the bulk, whatever that is, this what you call the end of the world brain would just be an initial state, like a quantum gravitational state. I mean, here you're giving a classical Euclidean description, but you know, in a full theory of quantum gravity, that's what it would be, right?
Well, I mean, we'll see later. It can have a purely geometrical description. So, it could involve some stringy degrees of freedom.
If you have a bulk theory of quantum gravity, then there's going to be the notion of initial state for that theory of quantum gravity.
Mm. But this is just a spatial boundary rather than a.
Exactly, but the states are labeled are exactly things that label spatial boundary. That's what I'm saying. In canonical whatever theory, spatial boundaries are in one-to-one correspondence with states.
You could make that. So, I mean, I think for my purposes, it doesn't really matter exactly what the description of this thing is. So it's encoding. So the red surface is sort of encoding some physics, which could be an internal space degenerating, or it could involve extra brains or microscopic degrees of freedom. I think it won't be particularly important, and we'll see what it is explicitly in an example later. The one thing that I want to mention is that there's one kind of very basic way to characterize any such brain. And so there's actually three kind of equivalent quantities that we can use. And so the first way to understand this quantity that characterizes the end of the world brain is just how much of the bulk geometry is left over when you draw this picture. Okay, so there would be, say, if you use Poincaré coordinates for ADS, there would be some angle here, and there'd be a certain amount of angle that you could go through where the space-time looks just like ADS. And then you hit some region where there are deviations from your previous ADS space-time, and that amount could be larger or smaller depending on the details of this brain. In bottom-up models, that is controlled by the tension of the brain. So this angle here increases if I increase the tension. What does that correspond to in terms of CFT language? So Takayanagi analyzed a situation in low dimensions, so 1+1 dimensional CFTs, and found that there is a correspondence between this tension parameter for the end of the world brain and the number of degrees of freedom, or something called the boundary entropy, which you can think of as like a measure of the number of boundary degrees of freedom for the CFT. The calculation he did was basically to look at the entanglement entropy of an interval, including the boundary. And computing this holographically, you calculate the area of an RT surface that has the shape that actually ends on this boundary. And then in the field theory side, that entanglement entropy of an interval, including the boundary, has a contribution that depends on which boundary condition you choose, and that's exactly this boundary entropy. Okay. So this will be kind of an important connection for the talk, that we're free to choose different possible boundary conditions in our CFT, adding more or less boundary degrees of freedom. In a bottom-up model, that would correspond to using an end-of-the-world brain with a larger tension. And geometrically, that larger tension gives rise to a larger angle here. So in our cosmology construction, we were interested in generating some end-of-the-world brain that localizes gravity. And in this simple case where we just have a single planar boundary, we can ask, what can we do in order to achieve that? So in this very simple scenario, when is it that gravity is actually localized on the end of the world brain? And this turns out to be true when this angle is sufficiently close to pi over 2. So when the angle is very large, or very close to pi over 2, then you see the brain is essentially acting like a cutoff surface for half of ADS. And then the arguments of Randall and Sundaram and Karch apply, and you find that you have localized gravity here. And so the suggestion here is that if we have a lot of boundary degrees of freedom that we add on this boundary, then that's sort of the limit we want to look at in order to end up with an end of the world brain that localizes gravity. And this is actually very sensible, because if we have very many boundary degrees of freedom, so if we have some, say, boundary central charge, which is much larger than the bulk central charge. So let's say in 4D, we could imagine starting with a 3D conformal field theory that's holographic and has many degrees of freedom, and then add the 4D theory onto that, couple these together, and take the 40 theory to have sort of relatively fewer degrees of freedom, fewer local degrees of freedom. Okay, so then you would be starting on the gravity side with a 40 gravity theory, and then perturbing that somehow, adding some 5D gravity degrees of freedom. But if you're only adding sort of relatively few, then you could imagine that maybe it's still a good approximation that you have this 4D gravity. Okay. So I'm going to, you know, later I'll talk about a microscopic model where this is N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, and we'll see that this is really possible to realize. Okay, so we've understood something about the gravity dual of holographic CFTs that have a boundary. That was a simple configuration where the boundary is planar. And now we want to go back and understand, use this knowledge of how holography works with boundaries in order to understand the gravity dual of this state that I constructed. Okay, so here's the state. And if we wanted to learn about this state, in the CFT, we would compute things like this, inserting operators at time equals zero, for example, in order to learn about the state or learn about its dual geometry. And so in ADS-CFT, we would say this particular Euclidean path integral corresponds to some gravity path integral. And then the gravity path integral would be in appropriate limits dominated by a saddle point configuration. And so then the usual story is that we just need to look for this saddle point. So we need to solve the bulk gravity equations with the boundary conditions that the asymptotic boundary of the space-time looks like this cylinder. So there are two possible topologies that tend to contribute in different cases. So if we think about bulk geometries that have boundary conditions that look like this, so this should be something like a part of ADS, but then with end of the world brains. And you could either have the end of the world brain coming from this top boundary just close off, and the end of the world brain coming from the bottom boundary close off. And that would give you a picture like this, where you have sort of a part of the ADS cylinder capped off by end of the world brains. Or you could have a more interesting topology where the end of the world brains actually join up from top to bottom. Okay. So these would be the Euclidean solutions that allow us to do these computations. How do we relate that to the Lorentzian state? We have to do some kind of analytic continuation. And the way that I like to think about it is that you can take the time equals zero slice of these geometries, which are time symmetric by construction, and that time equals zero slice in the Euclidean picture serves as the initial data for the Lorentzian evolution. Sometimes people describe this as taking the bottom half of the Euclidean geometry and then gluing it on to some Lorentzian geometry. I'm not a fan of that description. So we could just think of this particular slice as corresponding to a slice of the Lorentzian geometry. Okay. So let's understand the Lorentzian geometries in these two cases. So in the top case, you notice that the time equals zero slice doesn't involve any end of the world brain, simply a slice of the pure ADS geometry. And the expectation is that, so that would be dual to Lorentzian ADS, maybe with some excitations that don't back react. And this is sort of expected in the limit for large T zero. So for large Euclidean time, we thought the state should approach the vacuum state. And so we expect that it should be dual to something like ADS, maybe with a few particles in it. Okay. We're more interested in the other case. So for small values of this T0 parameter, the hope is that the other solution would dominate. This sort of makes sense that now that these two boundaries are coming close together. And so perhaps the action could be lowered by actually connecting the end of the world brain. If that happens, then we get a more interesting geometry. Now the time equals zero slice actually contains an end of the world brain at the inner boundary. And if you actually solve the equations and look at the geometry, this time equals zero slice is just a slice of a black hole geometry, where for positive tension end of the world brain, that's sitting behind the horizon. And then if you evolve that with the gravitational equations, you will find that the full Lorentzian spacetime is just this picture that I drew before. Okay, so this is how we understand that these states actually correspond to these kind of black hole geometries that I was hoping for. The next slide, I'm going to draw this same picture.
Just a question now, your yep. end of the world brain is line-like in your drawing?
The end of the world brain is has a spherical spatial geometry, which is some finite radius.
But it's a time-like, there's a time-like.
Oh, sorry, time-like, I thought you said finite. It's time-like, yes, it's time-like. So it has, well, it has spatial directions. It has three spatial directions that are a sphere and then a time-like direction. In the Lorentzian picture. Okay. So these pictures are just the same. This picture, if I suppress the sphere direction, okay, then I get this picture. And I want to emphasize that for our cosmology application, we wanted to get an end of the world brain that's quite far behind the horizon and serves as sort of a cutoff for the second asymptotic region. Okay. So that's just indicated in this picture. So depending on the tension parameter that we take for the end of the world brain in these gravity calculations, then we can either get something like this, where the end of the world brain is basically right at the horizon. This is the Euclidean solution. This is Lorentzian solution. If I increase this tension parameter, then the brain tends to move further out. And so it goes towards this asymptotic boundary in the Euclidean solution, and in the Lorentzian solution, it goes further out towards the second asymptotic boundary. Okay, so this is what we're trying to achieve. And so in 3D gravity, it turns out that like this is exactly the picture. You can tune the tension parameter of the end of the world brain in the gravity calculation to some critical value. And then this end of the world brain just goes all the way out. I'll mention later in 4D gravity, it doesn't seem to work as well. And so for the next few slides, I'm just going to be talking about 2D the 2D CFT or 3D gravity. And then I'll come back to the story with four dimensions. Okay. So indeed, in the 2D gravity calculation with this simple bottom-up model where we have a tension parameter, there's a critical value of the tension where the end of the world brain really does approach the second asymptotic region, second asymptotic boundary. And one nice thing that we understood recently with Jamie Sully and David Wickham is that you can actually verify this, like, basic gravity picture that comes out of a simple holographic model by direct CFT calculations. Okay. So you might ask, like, is there actually some evidence from the CFT that you really have this end of the world brain behind the horizon of your black hole? And so the way that we can actually see it is by looking at the entanglement entropy for an interval. So in the case of 3D gravity, then our original CFT is a 1+1 dimensional CFT on a circle. And so what I could do is look at the entanglement entropy for an interval on that circle. And then in the gravity picture, that entanglement entropy would be calculated by the area of some RT surface. For small interval size, the RT surface is completely outside the black hole horizon. But then as it increases the interval size, the RT surface probes deeper in. And then we actually have a phase transition at some point where the RT surface now is disconnected and ends on the end of the world brain. So the gravity calculation suggests that the behind the horizon geometry and the geometry of the end of the world brain can be probed by looking at the entanglement entropy for sufficiently large intervals in the CFT. And we have this specific gravity prediction if you calculate that precisely what is the entanglement entropy as a function of interval size, then we get this, we get these formulas. This is the condition for when the phase transition happens. So what we did recently with David and Jamie was to try to reproduce that using a direct CFT calculation. And so here we can calculate the entanglement entropy by evaluating the Reni entropies through the replica trick. So we're looking at basically calculating the partition function for the CFT on a multi-sheeted space, which is n copies of this glued across the cut. That turns into a calculation of the two-point function of some twist operator in our CFT. And it turns out that if you make the kind of standard assumption of vacuum block dominance, okay, so this two-point function in the CFT, you can actually expand it in two different channels, either a bulk channel where you use the OPE to write these two operators in terms of a bulk operator, and then you you express this thing as a sum of one-point functions of bulk operators in your boundary CFT. Or you can expand each of the bulk operators, each of the twist operators in terms of boundary operators, and then write your bulk two-point function as a sum of boundary two-point functions. Those are supposed to be equivalent. And the vacuum block dominance assumption would be that that for holographic CFTs, that calculation would be dominated by one channel or the other, just taking the identity block in either the bulk channel or the boundary channel. Okay. So if you make that assumption, then you get exactly this answer from the CFT. Actually, so I should say there's one additional assumption, which is that you don't have large one-point functions of operators in your bulk CFT. So that corresponds to the fact that we're not looking at solutions that have scalar fields turned on and other fields turned on. Okay, any questions about this CFT calculation?
So I think you described this mathematically, but I guess maybe if I were to get a physical picture of what are you doing to this CFT such that it gets, I guess, a modified entropy. Is there something more physical that you could tell me?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I'm not sure, I can make an analogy that may be helpful depending on. So this calculation, this phase transition in the entanglement entropy that I'm describing is very analogous to the calculation of the entanglement entropy for a pair of intervals in a CFT. Mm-hmm. And so when we move the pair of intervals further or closer, then we have a phase transition in the entanglement entropy. And that also comes from the transition between two different channels in the four-point function of twist operators. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if that is helpful, but this is kind of the CFT intuition that sometimes we have transitions between which channel dominates the identity block in one channel or the other dominates the calculation.
But I guess my question is in terms of, I mean, I'm looking at some field theory, and I guess I'm looking at a particular state of the field theory. Having an end of word brain in the bulk, I mean, what does it mean in terms of the state of the field theory that I'm looking at?
Okay, good. So yeah, it basically means that there's some, you know, if you look at simple observables in these states, they're thermal. But this end of the world brain means that if you look at something sufficiently complicated, like the entropy of a large enough interval, then you're seeing non-thermal behavior. So if you ask detailed enough questions, you're seeing non-thermal behavior. And I should mention that this non-thermal answer, it goes away after some time. So the phase transition is time dependent. And if you wait long, if you look at some specific entanglement entropy, and then you just wait some time, it makes a transition back to the thermal answer. So there's some non-thermal behavior, and then it thermalizes sharply.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay. So all of that was just to say that this 2D for the 2D CFTs or you know, 2 plus 1 dimensional bulk gravity or 1 plus 1 dimensional boundary gravity, the whole picture seems to work and there's evidence in the CFT. I should also mention that in some sense, this calculation gives an example of of an island in, so in thinking about various recent applications of ADS CFT, there's this island formula that's shown up. And if you think about this gravitational, so supposing gravity is localized here on this end of the world brain, the phenomenon that we're seeing is that the entanglement entropy of some degrees of freedom over here actually somehow involves, in the sort of doubly holographic picture, an entanglement wedge that includes, you know, both this region as well as some region on this end of the world brain. In the sort of effective description, what you're seeing is that there's just some region in your closed universe cosmology where you have degrees of freedom whose they're entangled with these other degrees of freedom outside. So
can I actually ask a question about this really quick? So
yeah.
I guess I have two questions. One is, I mean, at least in this picture, your brain is not like particularly close to the other boundary right behind the horizon. So is there like any critical values of beyond which you cannot go?
So there is some story like that. If the brain is, depending on where the brain is and how big the black hole is, and sometimes you can't actually probe the end of the world brain with this entanglement entropy.
So I don't know, how would you like interpret this then? I mean, right, like when you say that if you're so far away from this Randall-Sundrum limit, you get you get islands, but the closer you go and sort of like the better your approximation becomes, suddenly your islands start going away. And it seems like, well, you have nothing, you have sort of like no region in your CFT, which includes your universe now in your entanglement wedge.
Well, the whole CFT always includes it. Or if we did the open universe case where we had R3 instead of S3, then I could always look at a big enough region to see the island.
Okay, yeah, that was in my mind.
So I think it's not that the end of the world brain becomes invisible. It's just that you need to look at sort of the whole CFT now.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's get to 4D. First, I want to mention a problem that we encountered in the original analysis. We were looking at pure Einstein gravity with an end of the world brain characterized simply by a tension parameter. And I mentioned that as you increase the tension parameter, the end of the world brain goes further out. But in 4D, it didn't work to bring the end of the world brain all the way out to the second asymptotic boundary. So what happens before that is that the kind of trajectory of the end of the world brain overlaps itself. And so we seem to have some maximum distance behind the horizon that we can get the end of the world brain to be in this simple bottom-up holographic model. And so it sounded like we weren't able, at least in that simple setup, to do what we wanted to do. But it was very confusing because this means that only the very simple solution giving rise to pure ADS space seemed to be allowed in the limit where the tension is larger than some specific value, even if we take this tau zero parameter to be small. So if you take the gravity calculation seriously, it's suggesting that even in the limit where this amount of Euclidean evolution goes to zero, you're getting some finite energy state that looks, whose dual looks just like pure ADS. And that's sort of contrary to the expectations that these boundary states in CFTs are singular if you take this limit tau zero to zero. So my feeling is that it was probably just a problem with our gravitational action, that the actual CFTs require some more complicated gravity setup in order to model them properly. Some evidence for this came from follow-up work by Antonini and Swingle, who showed that if you just make the gravity theory a little bit more interesting, so you add a gauge field in the bulk and you allow your end of the world brain to be charged to couple to that gauge field, then they were able to find solutions where the end of the world brain goes all the way out to the asymptotic boundary. Okay, so that suggests that at least in the bottom-up approach, maybe just looking at some bottom-up gravity actions with more fields and more interesting couplings would allow you to get the proper description of this CFT physics. But I want to actually jump right to the microscopic situation.
You were talking about adding fields, but can you also just modify the brain action? Or
yeah, that might be true as well, right? So we just had a simple like brain cosmological constant, but maybe you just need to add like Einstein terms or other kinds of couplings in the brain action, and okay, maybe you'll get more general solutions. So I think this would be interesting to, definitely this is interesting to investigate.
Okay, thanks.
All right. So I actually want to understand in the field theory picture, how can we decide whether in this limit tau zero goes to zero? So that kind of simple gravity picture was suggesting that maybe the end of the world brains don't connect up even at that limit. So how could we evaluate this from the field theory picture? What would that mean in field theory if they never connect up, versus what does it mean when they do connect up? And so in this limit, then the physics of the field theory is going to go over to the physics of a field theory on an infinite strip. So you see, as tau zero goes to zero, we basically get a very long strip of this Euclidean field 4D field theory with two boundaries. And so that's this picture. The S3 becomes an R3. So we have our 4D CFT in here, and then two 3D, like our boundary degrees of freedom, we can think of those as being some 3D CFTs. Okay. Now this theory, so it's a Euclidean field theory. You see in the infrared, if we're at distance scales much larger than the distance between those two boundaries, then it should behave like some 3D field theory. And then the question is, does this thing flow down to some non-trivial fixed point, so some 3D CFT in the infrared, or does it flow down to a gap theory? And those two possibilities in field theory correspond to the two options that we have for our end of the world brain. If the end of the world brains don't connect, then we have some infinite amount of radial direction to go in, and you have arbitrarily long wavelength excitations. Whereas if the end of the world brains do connect, then you have an IR wall, and then this would be a holographic model of a 3D gapped theory, a 3D confining theory. Okay, so we want to understand, are there examples we can come up with where we realize the second picture? Okay, so we want to get a gapped theory, and we want to choose the number of these boundary degrees of freedom to be large relative to the number of bulk degrees of freedom in order that the gravity could be localized on this end of the world brain. So I'm going to start with our favorite four-dimensional conformal field theory, the N equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. And the kinds of boundary conditions that I'll choose are going to be boundary conditions that preserve a lot of supersymmetry. So eventually I'll introduce two boundaries, and together the boundary conditions will break supersymmetry, but the individual boundary conditions that I'm going to be looking at are supersymmetric. So there's this nice class of theories that were classified by Gaudo and Witten in about 370 pages of nice work. And the simplest version of that is to think about just the usual UN N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, where this would describe the low energy physics of ND3 brains. And you can understand the possible boundary conditions or the boundary theories that you can have as the theories where these D3 brains are ending on various collections of five brains in string theory. Okay. So if I have this setup where I have some D5 brains along certain directions and NS5 brains along certain directions, and then semi-infinite D3 brains that end there, and then possibly more D3 brains stretched between the five brains. The low energy physics of this is one of these boundary conformal field theories. Okay. And with the right orientation of the brains, this all preserves half of the supersymmetry. And so it has the same symmetries as some 3D superconformal theory. And one of the things you notice is that in the brain construction, I could put arbitrarily many extra D3 brains here between the five brains. And so this means I can change the boundary central charge independently of the bulk central charge. Okay, so I could have C boundary over C bulk to be as large as I want to. And that was something that we wanted to do in order to achieve this gravity localization. Okay, so the very nice thing about all of this is that the type 2B supergravity solutions dual to all of these boundary conditions have been worked out using the superconformal symmetry that the field theory has. You can actually find all possible solutions of type 2B supergravity with the right symmetry. Okay. So you can look in these papers for the details, but I'll just tell you a few basic things about these solutions. So the first thing to tell you is that the solutions basically realize the simple picture that I drew earlier in the talk. So for any of these solutions, they're asymptotically ADS5 times S5, where the boundary geometry is a half space. And the interior geometry, if we look in Poincaré coordinates, then as I said, for some range of Poincaré angle, you have basically ADS5 times S5. And then the S5 starts getting warped. And as you go further in, eventually the S5 changes completely, and it sort of degenerates in a more or less smooth way. Okay, so there's a more or less smooth solution of type 2B supergravity. The solutions here are characterized by the following picture. Okay, so they're actually preserving ADS4 or preserving SO32 times SO3 times SO3 bosonic symmetry. And so the duals are ADS4 times S2 times S2. And this is sort of fibered over some Riemann surface that we can take to be a quadrant of the plane. So the only thing I want to mention is that the data that specifies these solutions is actually just a set of numbers on the x-axis and a set of numbers on the y-axis. These are the poles of some harmonic functions, and these harmonic functions come into expressing the metric functions and form fields and dilaton for the solution. So for every choice of a set of Ks and a set of Ls, I get a supergravity solution.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yep.
You said that sort of the geometry is capping off smoothly in this another world brain region. Mm-hmm. Now, I would have thought that either for NS5 or D5, like for one of those two, maybe your dilaton sort of like goes in the wrong direction and like your gravitational coupling becomes strong.
Yeah. So I was going to clarify this point. Okay. So these particular points on this picture are associated with some kind of throats for either D5s or NS5s. Mm-hmm. So the blue ones are sort of associated with these D5 throats, and the red ones are associated with the NS5 throats. And so you have some kind of spherical geometry, but then there are some sort of throats, which are sources of D5 and NS5 flux. And so if you try to go down one of the throats, you can have situations where it becomes strongly curved or where the dilaton becomes large. So it's really more like a spiky ball that degenerates smoothly. But there are these places that have large curvature or large dilaton, but we sort of understand what's happening there in string theory. These are just places where you have some NS5s or D5s in the geometry. Okay. Great. Okay. So in terms of these parameters, these parameters are associated with the parameters in this picture that say how many brains you have. every one of these red dots corresponds to an NS5 brain, and every blue dot corresponds to a D5 brain in the construction. And it turns out the ADS radius is determined by this sum of the Ks and the Ls. So if we want to fix the asymptotic geometry, fix a particular curvature length scale in ADS, then we could still vary all of these Ks and Ls, or add more Ks and Ls such that this sum is preserved. And that gives us a lot of options for what the end of the world brain can look like. Okay. And in particular, what you find is if you make all of the Ks and Ls small like this, so going from this situation to, this situation, then you see that the end of the world brain actually can be pushed way out to the second, to the kind of asymptotic boundary that is missing because you've cut off half of the space. So this corresponds to having a lot of these poles, corresponds to having a very complicated set of boundary degrees of freedom with lots of D5 brains and NS5 brains. And I should say, you need to do this in a particular way. It's not sort of just arbitrary choices of taking small Ls and small Ks, but within this space of gravity, of supergravity solutions, there are solutions that where you could actually approach ADS5 times S5 in a limit. Okay, and so as we hoped, we can actually realize this Planck brain story even in the microscopic model. And so there's some specific boundary conditions that were boundary 3D CF superconformal theory that I can couple to n=4.5 space that kind of realizes this picture. So I want to think about those boundary conditions, those kinds of boundary conditions where I would localize gravity. And now I want to add in a second copy of the boundary. So I could do that in a supersymmetric way. So I could think about the theory with D3 brains ending on the D5s and NS5s and have more D5s and NS5s on the other side with the same orientation. And that would give me a theory that actually flows to a superconformal field theory in the infrared. So these theories preserve supersymmetry, and it's actually easy to see what they flow to in the infrared because it's just the limit of the brain construction where all the D3 brain lengths are taken to zero. So that kind of brain construction constructs some specific 3D superconformal field theory. So you can basically say exactly what happens in the IR. You choose this theory here and the same theory here, and then that flows to some other superconformal field theory in the infrared. So that's not what we want. And actually, it's not really what we were supposed to do in the first place. So remember, we were supposed to define the top half of our Euclidean path integral kind of like as a reflection of the bottom half. Okay, because our Euclidean path integral was coming from, like, we were supposed to think of the bottom half of the path integral as defining a state, and then the top half was supposed to be like the bra for that ket. And so if I do what we were supposed to do, then actually the orientation of these five brains would get reversed. Okay. So really what we want to consider is a case where you have n=4, one of these 3D superconformal field theories with a lot of degrees of freedom on the top, and then the mirror image of that on the bottom. And now either of these things on their own would preserve supersymmetry, but together, supersymmetry is broken. And a conjecture is that in this situation, we'll end up with a gap theory in the infrared, and that would correspond in the gravity picture to these end of the world brains connecting. Okay. So I'll try to give you a little, I don't have a proof of this, but I'll try to give you a little bit of of evidence and motivation for this statement. Okay. So first I want to remind you of a very early construction of Witten, who tried to define confining gauge theory using ADS CFT, using holographic CFTs. And what he said was, if you take some holographic CFT and you compactify it on a circle with anti-periodic boundary conditions for fermions. So these are boundary conditions that would break supersymmetry. Then the lower dimensional theory can be, would generically be gapped. And the way to understand it from the gravity point of view is that when you have this anti-periodic boundary conditions for fermions, then the circular direction that you've compactified on, it degenerates in the bulk. So it pinches off in the bulk. So you get a kind of cigar type geometry. And then that means that you have some infrared wall. And so the conformal field theory compactified on a circle with anti-periodic boundary conditions gives you a confining lower dimensional theory in the infrared. In our case, it's very similar. We have, instead of a circle with supersymmetry breaking boundary conditions, we have the higher dimensional theory compactified on an interval with boundary conditions that break supersymmetry. Okay, and they break it in this kind of non-local subtle way because of the incompatibility of the two boundary conditions. Okay. And so we could hope that in a similar way, the interval would pinch off in a similar way to Witten's circle pinching off. And that would give this picture where the interval is there in the UV, but as you go to the IR, eventually it pinches off. Another little bit of evidence for this is to consider kind of a probe analog of the brain construction. So we have N equals four, we have D3 brains stretched between various kinds of five brains. But we could also consider just D3 brains intersected by single five brains. And in that case, you could either consider the supersymmetry preserving configuration where the D5 brains are parallel, or the supersymmetry breaking configuration where you have a D5 anti-D5 pair. In this case, the field theory description has parallel defects that preserve supersymmetry, and the holographic dual has a probe D5 brain and another parallel probe D5 brain. Whereas in this case, studied by these authors, the field theory has a defect and then another defect with the opposite orientation. So together these break supersymmetry. And what you find that happens in the bulk is that the probe D5 brains now join up in the interior. And so you, in terms of the physics on this D5 brain, it's kind of gapped out as you go into the interior. Okay. So our situation is like a non-perturbative version of this, where now you replace the single D5 with some stack of NS5s and D5s and some stack of NS5s and anti-D5s. And so this doesn't prove anything, but if things behave in the same way once I add more and more five brains, then you might expect that in this supersymmetry breaking case, the end of the world brain, which is the analog of our probe brain, connects up in this case. And we've already seen it doesn't connect up in the supersymmetric case. Okay. So I guess in order to really be sure, one should do some supergravity analysis. So in principle, what we want to do to really understand whether these end of the world brains connect up and whether the solution does what we want is that we should just try to solve the supergravity equations with the asymptotic behavior corresponding to this chosen set of boundary conditions. So we know what the solution should look like in this region or in this region or close to the boundary of this bulk region. We know, or at least the probe example suggests that the geometry should preserve the symmetry. And so the fields in our type 2B supergravity solution are going to depend non-trivially on three coordinates. So unfortunately, it's a rather challenging gravity problem. But in principle, that would be the definitive thing to do in order to answer this question. So the question is, if you could solve that gravity, those gravity equations, is there some connected solution where, like, a solution where this effective end of the world brain joins up? And is that the least action solution if there's also some other solution? And then if you can find that solution, you could ask, does gravity actually localize? So short of doing that full analysis, one might also just try to find kind of the key elements with the supergravity action. Maybe it's just adding some gauge fields, or maybe it's just certain aspects of the type 2B supergravity action that would allow you to get the solutions that you want. So maybe one could understand just more from a bottom-up approach as before, how to realize the kinds of gravity solutions that we want. And maybe one can understand that certain features of the type 2B supergravity action will help give rise to the solutions that we need. So this is sort of a puzzle. One could try to approach it from the microscopic angle, or one could try to use kind of improved bottom-up models to try to find the right solutions. And I should just mention, there is sort of a puzzle. So in conversations with Henry Lin and Juan Maldacena, they pointed out what they consider to be a puzzle. So I'm not sure how sharp this puzzle is. So one thing to notice about this Euclidean solution here is that we're claiming that gravity should localize on this end of the world brain. And so that means that in the Euclidean picture, if you think of the effective description here, what we have realized is some kind of a Euclidean ADS wormhole. So it's a Euclidean ADS4 wormhole, and the geometry here, it's a planar cross section of the wormhole. So that's sort of interesting. And I guess the puzzle that was pointed out by Lin and Maldacena is that they tried to construct such wormholes in various ways. And it wasn't clear to them. I mean, it seemed difficult to them to actually come up with some effective description of such wormholes. So this is, I guess, related to the question of what sort of effective theory do you need, either in the gravity picture or in sort of an effective field theory picture, to describe this situation, if this is really the right situation. Okay. Yeah, maybe I just have a couple more slides, so hopefully it's okay. I'll finish up soon. I wanted to connect this, so tying into that that wormhole discussion, I wanted to connect this to a little bit of the recent discussion about wormholes in low dimensional theories of gravity. So quite a while ago, Maldacena and Mao is actually suggested that maybe you could do cosmology in ADS CFT if you could figure out how to describe a wormhole, a Euclidean wormhole, and then analytically continued, it would be some Big Bang, Big Crunch cosmology. So our construction basically does this, except the wormhole is realized as the effective description of an end of the world brain rather than the full gravity theory. Back when Maldacena and Mao wrote their paper, they were sort of confused by how you could represent these things in ADS CFT. And part of the confusion is that the geometry itself suggests that you have two CFTs involved in the construction. But if the CFTs are just decoupled, then you wouldn't expect there to be a connected geometry. The correlators in those pair of CFTs would factorize, and that factorization seems to be inconsistent with the gravity calculations you would do in a connected geometry. Okay, and so there have been various proposals for how do you actually realize these wormholes in ADS CFT. One proposal that originally appeared in Maldacena and Mao's paper and now has been realized in low dimensional examples is that these wormholes are dual to some ensemble averages of CFTs rather than individual CFTs. Another idea, for example, discussed in this paper is that maybe to get these wormholes, you should take two CFTs and then introduce some interactions between the CFTs. And then that could also explain the non-factorization of the correlators. Okay. So as I mentioned, our construction kind of generates a wormhole in the effective description. And so it's useful to see whether this lines up with either of these ideas. And in fact, it does. And in fact, it can be understood as either one of those ideas. So So a way to describe what we've done in our construction is that we're kind of starting with two holographic CFTs. So, you know, I talked about starting with a bulk CFT and adding these boundary degrees of freedom, but let's think about it the other way. So let's imagine starting with these two 3D holographic CFTs. Okay. Now these would be dual to sort of separate asymptotically ADS spacetimes. But what we do is we now couple these things to some auxiliary degrees of freedom. The auxiliary degrees of freedom are this higher dimensional CFT on a cylinder. Now, what happens is that this interaction somehow causes the two CFTs to, so these two CFTs sort of together, we said flow, they flow to some gap theory. So the gravity picture is that these two asymptotically ADS spacetimes somehow connect up in the bulk. And so it's maybe most obvious to say that this is an interaction between the two theories, but it's an interaction between these auxiliary degrees, mediated by these auxiliary degrees of freedom. But we could also actually view this as an ensemble average of theories. So if I think about kind of integrating out these auxiliary degrees of freedom, then what's left over is a product of partition functions where I take my original CFTs and I add some sources and I integrate over some probability distribution for these sources. Okay. So the full higher dimensional theory, I would have a boundary action here. I would have some interactions between those boundary degrees of freedom and the bulk degrees of freedom. And so that looks like a bulk field acting as a source for some boundary operator. And now if I think of the bulk path integral as just generating a probability distribution for that source, then we could rewrite this full path integral as an ensemble average of the product of partition functions for the two boundary CFTs integrated over these sources. I think that's it. Maybe one final thing I wanted to say was that, you know, if this construction works, then a very interesting question is, how do you calculate interesting cosmological observables starting from your microscopic CFT? So the kind of thing you'd want to do is take your microscopic description and then do a calculation that tells you, like, what are the initial conditions of the universe that you should put in when the effective field theory description takes over. And so in principle, we could do this because we have the exact microscopic description of this whole space-time. Okay, so I will stop there and take questions.
Okay, well, first, thanks a lot to Mark for giving this super interesting talk. Yeah, so are there any more questions?
I have a question.
Yes, please.
So there is the TT bar deformation, which corresponds to moving the boundary to some finite location. So I understand that's different from the brain. But I'm wondering whether there is some relation between these two, between the relevant and irrelevant deformation.
Yeah, this is a very good question, which I don't understand the answer to. Let me go back here. So let's take this simple. Let's take this simple situation where. Yeah, let's just take this simple situation here. So I'm suggesting that by choosing, you know, some specific conformal field theory to place on the boundary here, I can realize a picture here where you have almost all of ADS, but now it's cut off by a brain. And so you might have said, well, according to the TT bar literature, I could also sort of think of some maybe spatially dependent TT bar coupling that I turn on half of the space. So we could have no TT bar deformation on one half of the space, and then this TT bar deformation turns on, perhaps with a coefficient that's linear. I mean, just determined by some lower dimensional conformal invariance. And these two things look quite different to me. And I think it would be interesting to understand a possible connection. I mean, I guess personally, I'm still a little bit uncomfortable with the idea that the TT bar deformation really completely cuts off the asymptotic space-time. Although I know that there's quite a bit of evidence in different calculations, but I'm somehow confused how I should really think about the TT bar deformation. But if there were some connection here, I mean, since this seems to be doing a similar kind of thing, maybe there's some way of massaging this kind of construction and seeing that it's equivalent, but I'm confused about why it would be.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I don't think it will be equivalent because I think in the case here, you kind of don't have the boundary degrees of freedom on the brain.
Well, in my case, you're saying in the TT bar case that you don't have boundary degrees of freedom in the brain.
No, I mean, in this case, because when you say that, like, I can view this brain as there is an extra dimension which shrinks to zero.
Well, I guess
from the physical boundary.
Yeah, although it's a region of the geometry, and I can in these detailed constructions, I can still have sort of modes localized in this region of the geometry. So I think you can still think of there being some boundary degrees of freedom in my case, if you have a complicated geometry.
But you cannot define a region in this brain and then calculate it essentially using RT formula, for example. I mean, it could appear.
Yeah, you can. This you can do. I mean, you can certainly. So for example, I mean, one of the calculations that I haven't published with a student, Chris Waddell, actually maybe it'll come out next week, is for these kinds of theories, you can actually do a nice calculation of entanglement entropy for some hemisphere shaped region here.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of calculate it directly using the supergravity solutions by some RT surface that goes to this end of the world brain. And actually it can be dominated by the region of the end of the world brain. So it does kind of seem like you can have lots of degrees of freedom there if you want.
Yeah. Yeah. What I mean is that you don't define a region and calculate it as entropy. It's like the island, right? It's like which region contributes to your boundary, to the entropy of your boundary region is dynamically determined. It could be the island of some boundary region, but it won't be part of the boundary itself.
Okay.
Draw a region on the brain. Right. And say, I want to calculate the entropy of this region.
That's right. Yeah, it's like an island, right?
Thanks.
Okay, are there more questions?
Maybe just a general question about this point you discussed right at the end.
Yeah.
Is this like a general feature that ensemble averages could presumably just be viewed as, you know, some interacting theory that you got rid of some degrees of freedom? And does that have any implications in the 2D models that we think are ensemble averages?
Yeah, so it seems like it's not clear that you could always do that. So the ensemble averages that appear the ensemble averages that appear here are somewhat more complicated than the ones that appear in the 2D models. So, I mean, let's say we have a coupling here between boundary degrees of freedom on this strip to this CFT and a coupling here to this one. So, I mean, generally in the bulk path integral, the whatever field here couples to this theory is not going to be the same as the field here that couples to this one. So it's more of like a joint probability distribution for the sources between on the two sides are correlated, but they're not exactly the same. as they are in the ensemble averages that come up in the simple theories. And in the simple theories, we're really just taking exactly the same CFT on the top and the bottom and then just summing over the possibilities. So I'm not sure if, I mean, I guess maybe you could, maybe that's sort of a special limit of this where you take the thickness to zero. So I'm not totally sure it's always natural to write them as by adding extra degrees of freedom, but maybe there's a nice way. I mean, it would be interesting to investigate whether there's just a rewriting of those low dimensional theories that just looks like a single theory.
Yeah, I mean, it would maybe be conceptually nicer if it wasn't really an ensemble average, but yeah, anyways. Okay, yeah, thanks.
A small question here.
Yes.
I was thinking in terms of the FRW picture that you had on this end of the world brain. So there, the story is pretty complicated, right? You have this big bang and then inflationary phase and then radiation domination, matter domination, etc. All this complicated time evolution going on. So you how do we expect all of this encoded in the state of the CFT?
So, I mean, the...
this very complicated time evolution.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So, I mean, I guess two comments. One of them is that I guess I'm going to be satisfied even if we have some models of, if we can realize some models of cosmology where we can calculate what comes out of the Big Bang, even if it's not exactly the same as our universe, that would be a first step. Mm-hmm. But we do seem to have a lot of choices for which boundary state to pick. So even in that case where I chose n equals 4 and I looked at boundary conditions that correspond to that preserve half of the supersymmetry, even then there were a lot of parameters that I could imagine playing with. And so the specific choice of boundary conditions, I suppose, can give you a lot of possibilities for the dynamics. I mean, it'd be great if, you know, with, you mentioned the inflationary phase. So it seems interesting to understand, you know, in these simple examples. So I think I could relatively straightforwardly calculate cosmological correlators. And it would actually be interesting to see whether things can match with, say, predictions of inflationary scenarios without like explicitly building in inflation here. It's not clear that you necessarily, like, maybe there's some version of inflation, but this seems a little bit different, that you have some higher dimensional physics and you're emerging from this black hole singularity. And I don't know, it'd be interesting if this actually could simplify some features of the story. But all of the other things you mentioned, I mean, certainly there's matter, there's radiation. The effective description is going to look a lot like the effective descriptions that we use in cosmology. And people did a lot of work studying Randall-Sundrum cosmologies and found that, you know, I guess in certain situations you can agree with data. So it's not like totally out of the question that you can get it to work.
Thank you.
I guess I have also a question sort of in this cosmological direction. Did you ever think about sort of like generalizing this to say like a non-time symmetric situation or?
So it seems a bit tricky. Generally, when you have non-time symmetric situations, then things become complex in the Euclidean picture and it gets more complicated. So of course, well, I mean, maybe our universe will have a big crunch eventually, but if not, then we'd better understand how to do non-time symmetric situations. And I'm not entirely sure what you would do. I mean, of course you could just introduce some complex sources or at least perturbatively modify this so that it's not time symmetric, but it seems a bit complicated in general.
Hmm. And I guess my other question is, so, well, as far as I understand Randall-Sundrum, the theory you expect on this end of the world brain would be gravity coupled to sort of like a copy of your original CFT.
Yeah.
now, well, I guess like introducing like matter dominated, you know, like phase with massive particles would be something nice for cosmology. So
yeah, so one, right. So this is actually maybe an interesting point that you just brought up, that you know, here I took N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, and I was saying that I want C boundary to be much larger than C bulk. So I think one thing that I kind of find very interesting is the possibility that maybe all of this could work even if the bulk theory here is not holographic. I mean, it wasn't really the essential thing for us was that the boundary theory is holographic, and we got this, you know, gravity on the end of the world brain. So it'd actually be very interesting if we could take the bulk theory to be sort of non-holographic with fewer degrees of freedom. And I mean, you could even take it to be the standard model, and then you get the second copy of the cutoff standard model coupled to gravity, and it's almost doing what you want.
Okay, yeah, that sounds kind of cool.